WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Joseph Margulies, is a civil liberties lawyer who has represented several detainees in Guantanamo. He was the lead lawyer in a case that came before the Supreme Court called Rasool and Others versus George W. Bush that challenged the U.S. government's right to hold detainees indefinitely without counsel and without the right to challenge the claim that they were affiliated with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. In June 2004, the Supreme Court ruled that the detainees should have access to the courts to challenge their detention. In response to that decision, the Defense Department set up combatant status review tribunals, and Congress passed a law saying the only role for the courts is in determining if these tribunals are doing their job. The Supreme Court is about to rule on a related case, which will determine whether the law Congress passed should apply retroactively to all the detainees in Guantanamo. Margulies has written a new book called Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. He's an attorney with the MacArthur Justice Center and a law professor at Northwestern University Law School in Chicago. So what kind of recourse did detainees in Guantanamo win as a result of your Supreme Court decision?
The right to have a federal judge determine the lawfulness of their detention. What Rasool stands for is the proposition that the government must, the executive must come into court and justify the lawfulness of the detention, that no longer can they be held based only on the president's self-asserted authority and assertion that they are, in their words, the worst of the worst.
Now, after the decision, the Bush administration announced it had created combatant status review tribunals to determine whether prisoners in Guantanamo were enemy combatants. So where does that fit in with the Supreme Court case that you argued?
This was their response to the Supreme Court decision in Rasool. What we have learned is that they have a great reluctance for reasons that are unfortunate to ever defending the cases in court. I mean, since 9/11, they have yet to call their first witness in any post-9/11 detention case. That is, have a person in court saying, this is what this person did, and this is why we are holding them. Any Guantanamo case or Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, they've never gone into court and defended it. And what they did instead after the Supreme Court decision in Rasool was create these hearings down at the base, which lawyers aren't involved in. They rely on secret evidence that's withheld from the prisoner. The prisoner has to respond to allegations that he can't see. And not surprisingly, the administration concluded that all but a couple dozen of the prisoners at the base were in fact enemy combatants based on these combatant status review tribunals. They're a sham. They're really an embarrassment.
So in practicality, what detainees at Guantanamo won wasn't a right to a federal judge hearing their case, but rather the right to get heard before one of these military tribunals, one of these combatant status review tribunals.
That is correct. And none of them have yet had their case heard in federal court.
And they don't have a lawyer at these combatant status review tribunals?
No. No, in fact, they are explicitly not allowed a lawyer. If a lawyer had been representing, like my clients, I had been representing them for years, and or any of the other lawyers that have since gotten involved, they might represent them in the attempt to have the federal court hearings in the habeas cases that are going on in federal district court. And you would ask the military, let us go down and talk to our clients about this combatant status review tribunal. Even if you don't let us in the room, let us just advise him on what it is that's taking place and help investigate to help prove his innocence and so on. And we have been not allowed.
You were in a very unusual position when you were working on Rasool versus Bush, the Supreme Court case. You were representing prisoners who you never even had a chance to meet.
Right.
Why weren't you allowed to meet them?
Well, I was representing prisoners who didn't even know they had lawyers. They didn't even know that there was a case going on their behalf. And that was deliberate. The administration didn't allow them to learn that there was litigation on their behalf and wouldn't allow us to communicate with them or to deliver any papers to them. We represented the prisoners through their family members. That is, the family would say, we have learned that our son or husband is imprisoned at the base, and we know he would want to challenge that imprisonment. Would you represent him for us? And so we represented them through their family members, through the auspices of the family members. But the reason the administration wanted to keep them in this state of darkness is that's their model for interrogations. To understand Guantanamo, you have to understand that its objective was to be the perfect interrogation chamber. And their vision of intelligence gathering requires that you keep prisoners in this state of isolation and secrecy. So allowing them any link, any uncontrolled link to the outside world, was anathema to them. And so they restricted that and prevented it as long as they can. So the prisoners, we won in the Supreme Court, and our clients didn't even know that the case had been going on. We alerted them when we finally got to go down there.
How did it complicate your case being unable to meet with the people you were representing?
Well, the principal complication is that you can't, and this has been the struggle the whole time, you can't ascertain what it is that they supposedly did wrong and demonstrate its falsity. If the government doesn't make any allegations against a person, if they don't say, this is what he did on such and such an occasion, he took such and such actions against military personnel or their interests. And then you go talk to the person and you say, look, this is what they say you did. Let us investigate these. Well, none of that took place. There wasn't any of that. And in fact, they still haven't made those sort of representations in open court about what guys did so that there's an occasion for us to say, all right, well, call your first witness and we'll have a hearing on this.
As we said, while you were preparing your case for the Supreme Court, you were unable to meet your clients, but you were able to meet Mamdou Habib, one of your clients, I think on the day before you filed the brief in the Supreme Court. And you were afraid that if you introduced yourself to him, that he might suspect you of being in league with the interrogators, that this was just like another crafty way of getting information out of him. So you asked his wife to help you figure out a way to approach your client so that he'd believe that you were really his lawyer. Can
right.
you tell us a little bit what you did to try to achieve that?
Sure. First, let me correct one thing. I did not meet Mamdou until after the Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court case came down in late June of 2004. I was able finally to meet him shortly before Thanksgiving of 2004. But you're right. I was very concerned. We knew that interrogators had lied to prisoners. That's not uncommon. That in itself is not unusual. We knew that interrogators had impersonated other people. They had impersonated FBI agents, for instance, and the FBI had complained about it. And we had heard that Mamdou was not doing well physically and mentally. We had heard that from the Australian government. And so I had no confidence that he would think that I was anything other than another interrogator. So I met with his wife, who was living in Sydney at the time, and we actually, the people that I was working with on the case, we brought her to the United States, and I met with her over a number of days before I went down to the base. And I asked her to search her memory for obscure, innocent interactions between her and her husband that would signal to him that I had spoken with her, but stuff that an interrogator, even the most assiduous and careful, would not have thought to probe for. So we came up with three things. She told me where they went on their first date in Sydney, the first gift that Mamdou ever gave to her while they were dating, and where they stayed while their son was in the hospital having surgery. And because I thought, you know, it was so obscure that, and years ago, that no interrogator would have come up with it. And the first time I met with Mamdou, in these little boxes that pass for a prison cell down at the base, he's a very small man, and he was even smaller. He was bent over. He was shackled to the ground, bent over with his back to the door. And I came in and I introduced myself, and gradually, eventually, I told him these things. I told him that I had met with his wife, and she told me some things to help you to trust me. And it was a very moving moment because he started to cry. It was a very difficult thing for him. It was a very difficult thing for both of us, to be honest.
What do you know about what the government suspected him of having done?
Oh, they made the most serious allegations against him. They're some of the most serious allegations of anybody who was at Guantanamo. They said that he was a member of Al-Qaeda's inner circle, that he helped train the 9/11 hijackers, that at one point he was going to be one of the 9/11 hijackers, that he trained them in the martial arts, that he participated in video training of other potential or video surveillance of other potential targets, that he unloaded chemical weapons at some location in Afghanistan. There were very serious allegations. What we learned in the course of talking to him and examining the government's documents, and I can say this because it's all unclassified, is that all of this derived from, quote, confessions that he made after he had been rendered to the Egyptians. He was arrested in October of 2001 in Pakistan and sent to Egypt, where he was tortured for 6 months.
Sent by the U.S. to Egypt?
That's right. He was bundled onto a U.S. military plane at an airfield in Islamabad, put in blacked-out goggles, and they cut his clothes off of him, and they basically put a diaper on him and put him in a tracksuit and strapped him to a plane, the interior of a plane, and flew him to Cairo. And he was held at a prison outside of Cairo, a state security facility, where he was tortured for 6 months. And he confessed to all manner of crimes. And that's what they were basing his detention on.
If you confess only because you've been tortured and you've confessed to things that aren't true, is there any way of taking back the confession?
You know, one of my other clients, Shafiq Rasool, the answer to your question is no. He confessed. It's a fascinating story. They had a video of Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan giving a talk exhorting his followers. And they had circled, they took a still, a picture from the video, and they had circled the several faces. And they showed it to Shafiq Rasool and Asif Iqbal, two other clients. And they said, see this, this is you. This proves that you were in Afghanistan. And Shafiq kept saying, no, that's not me. When was this taken? You know, 2000. No, I was in 2000. I was living in England. I was working at a place called Curry's, it's a little fish place. I was going to school. It wasn't me. And they thought he was lying, and they put him in solitary confinement. They subjected him to something called stress and duress techniques, which are you're shackled in this squatting position for hours at a time. You can't stand, you can't lie down. Loud, cacophonous noises played, air conditioning turned way up, then back into solitary confinement for weeks. He later said he thought he was going out of his mind. And they'd bring him back, and they'd show him the photo again and said, that's you. We know that that's you. Finally, he confesses. He says, yeah, okay, yes, it's me. Turns out British intelligence later confirmed, because there was videotape that showed that Shafiq was, in fact, in England at the time that he said that he was. And he showed up, as you know, there's video cameras all over London, all over a lot of England. And he just happened to be walking down the street on video. And British intelligence gave that, as were my other clients, gave those videos to the United States. And Shafiq Rasool and Asif Iqbal have since been released. And they're home free men today. But if it weren't for the fortuitous and really random intervention of British intelligence, they'd be down at the base as, quote, confessed terrorists.
My guest is Joseph Margulies, author of Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is civil liberties lawyer Joseph Margulies. He represented several detainees in Guantanamo, and he took their case to the Supreme Court, arguing that they had a right to a legal process, and he won in the Supreme Court. He's written a book called Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. One of your clients, I think it was Mamdouh Habib, had fake menstrual blood smeared on him as part of the interrogation process, I suppose as a way to humiliate him and break him. To get him to talk. Would you tell us what he told you about that?
According to a reporting in the Washington Post, the Pentagon has confirmed, quote, numerous instances of occasions when interrogators, female interrogators, devised a plan to secret packets of dye inside their pants, which during interrogations of Muslim men, they would reach into and wipe their hands with it and then either flick or wipe this fake menstrual blood on prisoners. And the ostensible purpose was, as you say, to make them feel unclean. And then they would feel abandoned by their God and could not take comfort in any other outside source and would begin to learn that their only source of comfort in the world was cooperating with their interrogators. That's the ostensible purpose. In fact, they would, after the interrogations, they'd send them back to their cells and they would have turned the water off in their cells so they couldn't even wash. And Mamdou described basically that having happened. In his case, he said it was flicked on his face. And I remember the first time I heard that thinking, what do they think they're gaining? It's ostensible link to established interrogation techniques is something called pride and ego down. There's a military interrogation technique called pride and ego down, where you do things to try to diminish a prisoner's ego and pride in order to make them feel helpless. But nothing that the military had ever been authorized to do would sanction this sort of behavior, this sort of cultural assault. I was just mystified, just bewildered, if they think that this is going to lead them to reliable intelligence.
When your client Mamdou Habib was released from Guantanamo, and he'd been tortured in Egypt before this, he'd been detained for a long time and subjected to a lot of things in Guantanamo, no charges against him were officially ever made. When he was released after you won in the Supreme Court, you accompanied him home to Australia.
Right.
Just tell us a little bit about what that trip was like.
You know, that was very interesting. I consider myself extremely fortunate. I'm the only lawyer who has been allowed to accompany a client home. I'm not quite sure why they extended that courtesy to me. I think it was as a favor to the Australian government. But when they made the decision to release Habib, and it was announced first on Australian press, and this is early January of 2005, I got a call from the Australian government advising me that he was going to go home. And they asked me at first to keep it under my hat and not tell anybody because there were other negotiations that they were working out and they didn't tell me what, but they asked me not to tell anyone. And then about 10 days later, a week later, I got another call from the government and I said, and they asked me whether I would be willing to fly home with him when the time came. And I was, of course, I'd be happy to. And again, they said, keep it under your hat. Don't tell anybody. We don't want this to get out. But we need you on, you know, some day late in January of 2005 to meet us at midnight in the Miami International Airport at, such and such gate near the hotel. And we'll explain more when you get there. So I did. And there were representatives of the Australian government, somebody from their attorney general's office and several of their security members. And we took a taxi to the private charter terminal and boarded a Gulfstream jet, which flew from Miami to Guantanamo. And in the early morning hours, we picked up Mamdou. I had not been able to communicate with him and tell him that this was happening. And he had been told earlier that day by an interrogator, or by a guard rather, that they were sending him to Egypt. And they took him out of a truck. And it was dark, and there was a guard there that was videotaping the whole affair, and she had a spotlight on it, and Mamdou was sort of squinting into the light, and then he looked up and he saw me at the plane. The U.S. government wouldn't let me off the plane, so I was just at the window of the plane, and he walked over to me, and he said the first time he convinced himself that he was actually going home is when he saw me, and he walked up the steps of the plane, and I said, Mamdou, we're going to Sydney. You want to come?
So in retrospect now, what do you think is the reason that Mamdou Habib was detained in the first place? Do you think, I don't know if you have an opinion, and I don't know whether you feel it's appropriate for you to give your opinion, but do you think that he was an innocent who was mistakenly detained and sent to Egypt and then Guantanamo? Do you think he was guilty of anything?
All I can say is that if there were an atom's weight to the allegations that were made against him, he never would have been sent home. And it's not that as though they would need to hold him in Guantanamo. It's not that Guantanamo is this thing where you either let him go or you hold him in these current conditions. With the allegations they made against Mamdou, they could have brought him back here and tried him in a federal court in a heartbeat if those allegations were true. And they would have. As I said, they were extremely inflammatory allegations. And for him to be released and under no restrictions at all in Australia, he's not in custody there, indicates to me that they did not believe the allegations that they were making. If there were other evidence to indicate he is anything other than a person who was in Pakistan looking for a job and looking to move there, he wanted to move from Australia to Pakistan to be in a more religious environment. If there were anything that he was anything other than that, the United States government has not shown it to me.
Do you think he was a sympathizer with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda?
I don't know. I don't have any reason to believe that. He is a strict Muslim, but that establishes nothing. I think it's very important, and the administration agrees with this, that if we're going to say that this is a war on terror and not a war on Islam, that there is no crime in being a strict and observant Muslim.
Joseph Margulies is the author of the new book Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with civil liberties lawyer Joseph Margulies. He's represented several Guantanamo detainees and was the lead lawyer in a case that came before the Supreme Court, Rasool versus Bush, that challenged the government's right to hold detainees indefinitely without counsel and without the right to challenge the claim that they were affiliated with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. The court ruled that detainees should have access to courts to challenge their detention. Margulies has written a new book called Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. Let's look at some of the legal arguments that you made in the Supreme Court case. The Bush administration was arguing that Guantanamo is outside of U.S. jurisdiction because it's officially under Cuban sovereignty, so that the U.S. court system doesn't apply there. How did you challenge that aspect of the Bush administration argument?
Yeah, the administration's argument was that really we weren't sovereign at Guantanamo, despite all appearances to the contrary, that really Cuba was sovereign, and therefore the courts have no role. And I used to call that argument the Guantanamo fiction, because everybody accepts that Guantanamo is ours. It is U.S. territory. I mean, there's a Starbucks, there's a McDonald's, there's a movie theater, there's a Boy Scout troop, there's a Baskin-Robbins. It's larger than the island of Manhattan. It's more than half the size of the District of Columbia. There's no other law that applies there. I mean, it is, in all respects, a small American city. And the question was whether this legal fiction of sovereignty is going to displace American law. And the Supreme Court said no. We're going to look to the reality of events. And the reality is this place is, in all respects, within the territory of the United States. And therefore, the law will reach those prisoners.
Now, the Bush administration made the argument that the detainees in Guantanamo are enemy combatants, not prisoners of war. Therefore, the Geneva Conventions don't apply to them. What was your argument?
Well, in Rasool, the position was that the federal courts reach them, whatever you call them, the government has to demonstrate the lawfulness of their detention. That argument is made more important and more urgent if the government also says, not only do we not have to justify why they're there, we can treat them any way we want. And our position is that whatever you call them, you don't have the right to torture them. You don't have a right to use cruel and degrading and inhuman and humiliating interrogation techniques. You can call them anything you like, and you can make up any name, and the label enemy combatant is not in the Geneva Conventions. It's not in U.S. military lexicon. It's just a name they came up with. We don't want to get stuck on the tyranny of titles. The fact is they're prisoners in an armed conflict, and you can't mistreat them.
You point out in your book that there's actually four different Geneva Conventions. One applies to POWs. One applies to civilians. You point out right. that there's one article that exists in each of the four Geneva Conventions, so that no matter who you are, no matter what your status is, you at least get the protections of this Article 3, which is in each of the four conventions. What does that That's Article right. 3 say?
Common Article 3 is the baseline minimum that says no matter who you are, no matter how we've captured you, no matter what we think you've done, there are certain things that will make sure that that war, despite its inevitable horrors, war will not become this descent into anarchy. We will not mistreat prisoners in our care. And maybe you don't want to call them prisoners because that sounds like prisoners of war. You want to call them something else. The fact is, Common Article 3 is the baseline. And that's the position recognized by the U.S. military and has always been recognized. It's the position to this day pressed by the U.S. military. And the administration refuses to accept that the people picked up in the war on terror are entitled to those baseline protections. They refuse to give them the protections of Common Article 3. It's really an astounding lapse that the rest of the world just shakes their head over, and the U.S. military.
No, prisoners of war don't get trials. Now, I know the right. detainees in Guantanamo have not been categorized as prisoners of war, but still, if prisoners of war don't get trials, why should the detainees in Guantanamo get trials?
Well, when you say trial, the position we've said is not that they have to have regular criminal trials in a federal court with the jury and all that. Our position has always been you have the right to hold them. You simply can't hold them lawlessly. You have the right to detain prisoners. You simply cannot abuse that right. So the idea in Rasool is, look, if you're not going to give them the benefit of the Geneva Conventions, if you're not going to give them some process by which we determine whether you've got the wrong guy so that we can separate the wheat from the chaff, you've got to provide some other process in court so that there is some restraint on executive authority. And that's been the problem with the administration. They take all the power that comes from war, saying we can hold them forever for as long as the conflict lasts and do everything we want with them, but they accept none of the restraints on the use of that power. And Rasool was about restoring that balance between power asserted and power restrained.
Now, President Bush very recently said he would like to close Guantanamo because it's outside the American justice system. A UN panel monitoring compliance with the Convention Against Torture has called for shutting down Guantanamo. Many other people have called for shutting it down as well. What do you think the odds are that it will be shut down?
Well, it's clearly going to be shut down eventually. The question is how long and what more disasters befall us in the meantime. I have to say, they've been saying for months, really years now, that they're going to shut it down any day or that they're going to make major changes any day. Last August of 2005, for instance, they said, we're going to release 70% of the prisoners and the great majority of those who remain will be moved to this new camp, Camp 6, which is modeled after, which complies with the Geneva Convention and it's much more humane and so on. Well, meanwhile, nobody talks about that anymore and they haven't built Camp 6 and there's still roughly the same number of prisoners there. And it continues to be a domestic and international disaster.
Are you concerned that if Guantanamo is shut down, it's possible that a new facility will be built that will have the same problems?
It's already been built. One of the things that people don't know is since the decision in Rasool, which was the end of June of 2004, there's been only one plane load of prisoners that have come to the base. There were 10 additional prisoners that came in September of 2004. Meanwhile, the prison at Bagram Air Base has ballooned from 100 prisoners to 600 prisoners. It's become the new Guantanamo.
This is in Afghanistan.
That's right. Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. The conditions in Bagram are apparently even more primitive than at Guantanamo. But you know, no reporter has ever seen it. There are no photographs of it. My information on it is based on a story by Tim Golden of the New York Times a few months ago. So it's you know, you put your finger on the ball of mercury that is Guantanamo, and it squirts off somewhere else, and now it's at Bagram.
My guest is civil liberties lawyer Joseph Margulies, author of Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph Margulies. He's the author of the new book, Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. He's a civil liberties lawyer who represented several detainees in Guantanamo in a Supreme Court case arguing that they and other detainees had a right to a legal process. His legal team won the case. There were recently three suicides in Guantanamo. Do you have any interpretation of those suicides?
I don't think it's coincidental that they were all discovered at the same time. They were all on the same cell block. They were in Camp 1. Camp 1 is not the highest security facility. It is not for the most, the prison perceives as the worst discipline problems. But no one should be surprised by it. The last year that they released data on this was 2003, and there were something like 350 what they call self-harm gestures at Guantanamo, and 120, quote, hanging gestures. They don't really explain what that is, but they have been warned by the Red Cross and by various other human rights groups of the risk of suicide for years. The most precious commodity in any prison is not a slightly larger cell. It's not a change of clothes, it's not sunlight, it's hope. And unless you allow a prisoner to hope that there will be release, that he will go home and be reunited with his family, he will be overcome gradually by despair. And when a prisoner is overcome with despair, he will kill himself. And that's why the prison fully expects, the military fully expects, there'll be more attempts, because the war on terror makes hope impossible.
There's another Supreme Court decision regarding Guantanamo that's expected to come down, I believe, sometime this month. Would you talk about the decision and what you think is at stake in it?
Well, the case is called Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, and it has to do with the military commissions. And it's raises two questions. One is whether and to what extent the courts have a role in continuing to police the events down at Guantanamo, whether that has been displaced by legislation that was passed at the end of last year, and assuming they have a role, whether the military commissions are constitutional. And it's going to be decided in a couple of days. No one knows how that's going to come out, but we expect that the court will say that the courts do continue to have a role. And so what we are hoping is that it will finally break the logjam and we will be able to vindicate the right that was established in Rasul, and courts will now start to measure the government's justifications for these detentions. In other words, we'll finally have hearings. That's what we're hoping for.
So you're hoping that there will be hearings as opposed to the military tribunals that are operating now?
Right. Our position is that these cases should be in a federal courtroom. That the military commission should be pursuant to established military rules, like the rules governing court-martials, and that the non-military commissions, again, the military commissions, there's only 10 guys charged. The other 450 who are at the base are charged with nothing. That those would be handled in a federal court. That if the government can, and I'm not talking about a full-blown trial, just if the government can come into court, have a hearing, show what it is that they've done, they can either convince a judge that this guy should be held, or they can't. If they can't convince a judge, you let him go. We could, if they'd have had those hearings after Rasul, they would have been done with them in, you know, September of 2004. We could have finished them all in 90 days. And then they've yet to have the first one.
Explain for us why you think the detainees at Guantanamo should have court hearings as opposed to having what they have now, which is combatant status review tribunals run by the military.
The essence of the role of the court is to ensure the integrity and reliability of the process. That's what judges do. So, for instance, one thing that you can't do in a regular courtroom is use evidence secured by torture. Well, the combatant status review tribunal doesn't have that prohibition, and you can hold a person in custody based on statements that he made or that other people made about him under the most extreme interrogation techniques. Witness Mamdouh Habib, who was held based on what they did to him in Egypt. Well, you could never do that if you had to present this evidence in a court of law, right? Because the law turns its back on that sort of evidence. In addition, you have a neutral arbiter. You have a federal judge who is not beholden to the military. That's what due process means. What it means is a fair and impartial hearing with notice and an opportunity to be heard. That's what makes the United States judicial system the envy of the world. That's what will quell the outcry about Guantanamo. And that's what they have refused to do.
One argument I've heard made against what you're proposing is that it would tie up the federal court system. We don't have enough judges.
There's 450 guys there. We could finish these hearings in 5 months. That's preposterous. That's just preposterous.
Just one more thing. You've done all kinds of civil liberties prison cases, you know, over the years, but nothing quite like Guantanamo. I mean, there hasn't been anything quite like Guantanamo. So looking back on your experiences, it must have been an incredible learning process for you. Just tell us how you think it's kind of changed you as a lawyer or as a person to have had this experience.
I consider myself very fortunate to have been involved in this. I consider myself honored to have been given the opportunity to accompany my client home. I would be lying, however, if I didn't tell you that I found being at the prison very disturbing. I've been at prisons all over the country. I've been on death row in, I think, half a dozen states. And the prison at Guantanamo was the most disturbing place I'd ever seen. I consider myself fortunate, but it was deeply unsettling.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joseph Margulies is the author of the new book, Guantanamo and the Abuse of Presidential Power. Coming up, Richard Samp, the chief counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation, which has filed Supreme Court briefs in support of the Bush administration position on Guantanamo. This is Fresh Air.